Here's a story I heard from the best writer I know, a Utah guy named Scott Carrier.
My editor called me up and said, "We want to send you on the fishing trip of your dreams, and something like that is going to go wrong. I mean, you start at the top, there's no way to go but down."
That kind of sensibility, "I think the bus is going off the road, but I'm getting on for the ride anyway," colors many of his stories and most of his work collected in a new book, Running After Antelope.
The fishing story where you actually catch a fish, that has been done. Hemingway did that in Big Two-Hearted River, and it's never going to be any better than that. No one's going to beat that. And basically the kind of experience that I have in my own nature, I've had a lot of experience at, you know, sort of not catching fish. And I thought I could write an interesting story where, you know, basically maybe there's no fish that's caught.
The story wound up in Esquire magazine, which has published a lot of Scott Carrier's work in recent years. He's in Harper's, too, with essays and accounts of people that many of us overlook. Losers who can't catch fish, cranks, oddballs, believers in things most of us cannot see and often don't want to.
I think they like it. I think people like to be written about, even if perhaps the portrait's not so complimentary. People like to be seen. They like to be recognized. And a good writer can see people so quickly and so clearly that they feel honored because they've been seen.
Most of the people you write about, probably you're the only writer these people have encountered.
Yeah. They've always wanted to be on TV. Sometimes I get that.
So you don't ever have the sense that maybe you're violating people's privacy or intruding in their lives when you come to write about them?
Yeah, I do. I feel that. But when I first approach a person, I introduce myself and tell them what I'm doing. You know, I tell them I'm an independent radio producer and a freelance writer. And at that time, they make a decision whether they want to talk to me or not.
Are your stories all true?
In what sense do you mean true?
Well, in the sense that they really happened.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, to begin with, it's hard to tell when people are telling you the truth. And it's hard to tell sometimes when you're telling the truth to yourself or lying to yourself. You know, Jack Kerouac has a good saying. He said, "Everything I wrote was true because I believed in what I saw." And I think that's really a pretty bulletproof position. You know, you have to take a stance at some point. If you're going to be a reporter, you're the eyes, you're the witness for your readers or your listeners. And I believe they expect me to do that. That's what I want anyway when I listen to the radio or read an article. You know, I want there to be objective news reporting, but I also want there to be subjective reporting as well.
Do you think of yourself as a reporter?
I think of myself as a reporter, yeah. Basically, when I write a story, the one thing I'm trying to answer is what happened, you know? And I think that's what a reporter's job is. What happened?
You may know Scott Carrier because he's a contributor to Ira Glass's public radio show, This American Life. And he began years ago as a freelance writer and producer for NPR with a startlingly original sense of story. Like reimagining Utah's West Desert as a vast, crystalline golf course.
The mountain in the distance is called Floating Island. Up high, there are animals, trees, and fish. But down here, nothing. No rocks or bushes, no ditches. There are no real hazards, except for the bombing range, which is big but easy to avoid, and the mental hazard of being spooked by the emptiness.
Place matters a lot in his writing, and character, too. Radio reporters, of course, can rely on recorded tape to explain details. But when people talked to Scott about his work, he found they actually liked the narration that came between the taped segments, liked hearing his open, outdoors voice simply reading what he'd written.
The first white men came to this desert in the 1820s looking for beaver and the Rio Buenaventura, the river they thought connected the Great Salt Lake with the Pacific Ocean. They came in young, on horseback. A few weeks later, they staggered out, having eaten their horses, having abandoned their friends, having forgotten their own names. Their reports were full of horrors. There are no beaver, there is no river, Everywhere the water just disappears into the ground. The Indians live like animals, their houses nothing more than hovels made from little sticks, their clothes made from the same sticks, food, whatever they pick up off the ground, insects, lizards, rats. Like dogs, they hunt without weapons. They're all witches. They can charm animals into their camp by beating a drum and dancing. Captain Howard Stansberry of the U.S. Corps of Topographical Engineers, the first white man to walk around the Great Salt Lake, said, "These Indians are the most degraded savages, and their country is entirely worthless."
He's almost always lived in Salt Lake, often subsisting from one tenuous freelance contract to the next. He used to hitchhike to assignments, sometimes using those he met along the way in stories of what happened. Nearly broke a couple of years ago, he hitched to New York to see his publisher.
You know, that was the best bet at getting some money. And I actually thought that I could. When I went, I thought, if I just go and stay there and wait for him to give me the money, maybe it'll work.
Did it work?
No. They just laughed at such a notion.
But now the book is out. The title story, Running After Antelope, is about a theory proposed by his biologist brother that ancient people used to catch wild game by chasing it down, a piece that Scott had tried first on radio.
So we were running after these three and feeling pretty good about not letting them ditch us. And a couple times, we even got within 50 yards of them. And I'd look into their eyes, trying to see some sign of fear or fatigue. But all I kept seeing were very quiet animals that seemed to know exactly who we were, what we were proposing, and didn't seem to be in the least bit worried.
Are you still trying to run down an antelope?
No, not lately. I think I will. I think there'll be a rematch.
Do you really, really think that if you thought better about it?
Yeah, you can do it. I think it's possible, but I think it would take a lot of work and a lot of time and probably at least five people. I think it's possible. I mean, there are ethnographic reports of primitive people, primitive hunters doing it, and I believe those. I mean, it seems clear that people can charm antelope and deer and to catch them that way. So, and that counts as hunting without weapons, but it's not running them to exhaustion.
I haven't gone back to Wyoming for the purpose of chasing antelope, but I drive through there sometimes on my way somewhere else. And one time last spring, I was going east, and there was a train along the highway also going east at about the same speed. And suddenly, there were three antelope running alongside the engine, chasing it. It was incredible. It was even more incredible to see the three of them simultaneously speed up, pull out in front of the engine, and fly across the tracks. I pulled over and waited for the train to go by, and there they were, three young males, looking back at me with those same black eyes and hardly breathing at all.
Writer and radio reporter Scott Carrier, whose stories are collected in a new book, Running After Antelope.